Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
Tiger Woods will recover as a golfer. Whether he can recover as a person, I think, is a very open question, and it's a tragic situation with him. I think he's lost his family. It's not clear to me that whether he'll be able to have a relationship with his children. But the Tiger Woods that emerges once the news value dies out of this scandal, the extent to which he can recover, it seems to me, depends on his faith. He's said to be a Buddhist. I don't think that faith offers the kind of forgiveness and redemption that is offered by the Christian faith. So my message to Tiger would be, Tiger, turn to the Christian faith, and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world.
Well, Vic's concerned about Tiger's soul, which is admirable. I just made a more straightforward sports prediction, which is that he'll come back and win the Masters, because, you know, he's still an awfully good golfer, despite the chaos and bad news about his personal life.
Now, what kind of reaction did you get when you said that? Did you get a lot of letters and emails and things?
I got some letters and emails from people who are like me or who are believers who said, well, great, wait on, right on, way to go. I've heard a lot of unfavorable comment from people who claimed that I was a pompous jerk who had no business mouthing off on the subject and that I shouldn't have belittled the Buddhist faith and so on. I really wasn't trying to deliver
I don't think so either. What do you think drives the negative comments about, Buddhism aside, I don't think you were trying to denigrate Buddhism, but what do you think drives the negative comments about Christianity?
It has always been a puzzling thing to me. The Bible even speaks of it, that you speak the name Jesus Christ, and I don't mean to make a pun here, but all hell breaks loose, and it has always been thus. It is explosive. I didn't even say the name in that way. I simply spoke of the Christian faith, but that was enough to trigger this reaction. It triggers a very powerful reaction in people who do not share the faith and who do not believe in it.
All right. Appreciate it, everybody. Thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Obviously, that wasn't me. Someone is channeling going, wow, James sounds like Brett Hume all of a sudden. You've probably heard the first clip, which I guess was from Fox News Sunday, and Britt Hume in the sports predictions, in essence saying, Tiger Woods, Buddhism doesn't offer you forgiveness, but Christianity does. And even on NBC this morning, the Today Show, in covering the daily segment of the Tiger Woods saga, which I almost never have on. I just happened to this morning, especially because I was wondering if they might do this. They present it, and just as secular media people do, it's just like, crazy Brit Hume. You know, he's nuts. He's lost it. He's out there in the crazy zone. You have to realize the primary nature of Brit Hume's heresy, because that's why there has been such, a totally expected backlash in the media. I think someone tweeted this morning that over at richarddawkins.net they were going insane, which you'd expect the atheists to go insane. As soon as you say the name of Jesus, they will go insane. They are to secularistic materialism what Torquemada was to the Inquisition. I mean, those folks are so far out there, they want us to be charged with child abuse for introducing our children to any type of religious thought. They are the best example I could think of where secularism really wants to go. But you would need to understand Brit Hume's primary heresy. Yes, there is heresy in what he said, because it assumes that there is truth in religion, that one religious opinion is better than another religious opinion, which, of course, is heretical from our society's perspective. But that wasn't the primary heresy. It's there. But the primary heresy you need to understand is the fact that he uttered these words in the inner holy sanctum of secularism called the media. It was where he said it. The very fact that he would say it in that context with cameras rolling, knowing that there wasn't anything that anybody could do about it. They couldn't cut to a commercial. They couldn't bail out on him. He said what he said. It was a 54-second clip, less than a minute. But you just need to understand, for secularists, for the naturalistic materialists of the world, that was a heretical act. It was a clear violation of what is acceptable from their perspective. They are offended that someone would dare to speak a word about Christianity in that context. Now, I don't know anything about Brit Hume's theology. I don't know where he goes to church. But he didn't say anything outside of the basic statement that is a true statement. And that is, Buddhism does not offer redemption. And classical, historical Buddhist theology doesn't. It may offer a way out of sexual addiction in the sense of teaching you, or at least instructing you as to how to allegedly rid yourself of these desires. I would argue that it accomplishes nothing along those lines. But the idea of redemption is really only accomplished through many lives of reincarnation. The idea of redemption, as Brit Hume was using the word, is not there. So it was a factual statement in regards to the contrast that he drew. And the main thing that angers people would be that anyone would dare to think that Tiger Woods should repent and believe, which, of course, is the Christian message, which you all have your religious broadcasting, you all have your church. Keep it out of the public sphere. We, the secularists, reign here, and we will rule with an iron fist. And once again, parents, as you talk with your children, believers, as you talk together in the church, you must keep reminding one another, secularism is just as much a worldview. It is just as much the maker of priorities in thought and action as any theistic religion. It is a religion. It's just a non-theistic religion. And yet it is demanding that the governmental structures of Western societies promulgate its fundamental tenets with our tax money, and that we are to be silent about these things. That is, here's just another example. I mean, you can come up with these on a regular basis, not quite as high profile as this, but you can come up with this kind of example over and over and over again.
The scuttlebutt I'd heard this morning was there was two trains of thought flying around the liberal bloggers today, and the number one one was apparently repeated on MSNBC, and that was, you know, didn't your mother always tell you that you're not to speak about religion in public, and that this was the great sin because Brit Hume spoke of his religion in public on a politics show, and that's the next thing they went with, and that was by speaking about his religion on a show about politics, did he not degrade his religion that should have been sanctified in the pulpit instead?
Absurdity.
And it's absurdity. Like, oh my gosh.
Pure absurdity, again, just based upon the idea that, look, this is only stuff that you can talk about within the confines of your church building. It is not allowed out here where the rest of us are. We will be offended. Well, excuse me, Mr. Secularist, I am offended at your secularism. I am offended at your discussion of the world that my Lord created where you deny him. You offend me every single day. Now, we are equally offended. Can we grow up enough to get past that and discuss the truth, please? It is a fundamental immaturity on the part of the thinking of the secularist to behave in this fashion. And all you got to do is look at the wild-eyed leftist blogs today, and you will see the childlike nature of so much of this kind of behavior. It is an amazing thing to observe. But it's something we must think about. We must over and over and over again with our children, with each other, point out the times when people who are absolutely fundamentalist secularists demand that their worldview be given the priority, support out of the public coffers and be made the religion of the nation. But then we are to just shut up. We have to point these things out. We have to recognize these things and think about these things and be able to talk with others about them. Because as irrational as the postmodern mindset is, the person you're talking to is still created in the image of God. There is still that conscience in there. There is still that imago Dei that we can appeal to. So just a thought as I was considering this morning. It was the first thing that popped up, a clip from, the original statement, and then O'Reilly talking to Hume about it, I guess, last evening, something like that. I'm not sure when it was. Probably last night. I had not caught that, but it is interesting to look at. 877-753-3341. I do have my Twitter fixed. I tried to install TweetDeck on this unit, and it just blue screened of death every single time you tried to run the installer. Just it ain't going in. I have been given the okay to put together a system and give it to Mr. Pierce to put on the blog and the shopping cart to update this system that is sitting in front of me. Those of you who watch maybe some of the YouTube videos, you'll see the computer down there. Well, it's a very old Windows unit, and it unfortunately sometimes I ask it for a browser window. A couple days ago, or last week, I asked it for a browser window, and I checked it. It took 91 seconds.
So, well, you know, a lot of people, while you're on this topic for a moment, a lot of folks don't necessarily realize, they kind of marvel at how much we get done around here.
Yes.
And just being two of us. And
well, there's somebody hiding behind.
Well,
you,
every now and then we get the volunteers. We get
the random volunteers.
And
he's pretty random too.
In a lot of cases, they don't realize we rely very heavily on technology.
Oh yeah.
And we have for years, and for the longest time, we relied on that with a very shoestring budget.
One EMP and we're done.
Oh, game over. Yeah. But we were building the machines, just like I said, in the dividing line machine, which arrived today.
Yes,
in the boxes.
Does.
So we're going to start putting it together soon. And
are you going to try to get it in by Thursday?
Oh no. No.
That's right. You're gone tomorrow anyways.
So. If I can get him in and up and running by the end of the month, I'll really be happy.
What was that about technology again, Rich?
We rely heavily on it, but we also rely heavily on time.
That's
and
right.
It's end of year and all that happening as well. So I've got a number of hats to wear. But, you know, like you said, 90 seconds to bring up a browser window. Of course, you know, we might want to actually try to run something on that, like, you know, maybe defrag or something like that.
Oh, believe me, I run it constantly.
Well,
it's just an old machine.
The mouse is very tired.
It had problems when I first got it, to be honest with you. I've nursed this baby along for a long, long time. It's many years old. I've asked it to do many, many things. It's right now sitting here showing the parking lot, the phones, the chat channel, and a Bible program, and then playing those videos. So, it wasn't the top of the line we got the first time. So make a long story short, then obviously normally what we do is we do the hand-me-down thing. For years, you did the hand-me-down thing.
Yeah.
I'd give you whatever I had just upgraded from. And but now, as of August of 2008, I saw the light. I experienced freedom from – yes. Freedom from slavery, and now I have a Macintosh, and so make a long story short, it would solve a lot of things to bring my current unit in here to the Dividing Line studio and use it as my unit for the Dividing Line, which of course means getting one that I would then be using regularly outside of that. So we'll work toward that end. One that would have a little bigger hard drive. so that I could do the videos, especially when I'm on the road. Anyway, we'll be talking about that. But I did fix my Twitter problem that I had last time. I really want to apologize to everyone who did send me questions on New Year's Eve by Twitter. I just couldn't see them. I wasn't set up properly on the web to see them right. I now have installed EchoPhone or EchoPhone or whatever it is on this unit, and it's running under Mozilla Firefox. And so I think it'll work. So if you want to try, Dr. Oakley 1689 should work today. I should be able to see it coming up and utilize it that way. Now, before we go to any of our phone calls, which we only have one at the moment, I'm not sure it's going to be coming through anyways, I promised something on New Year's Eve, and I want to follow through, and it is somewhat indicative of our program and what we do here, that we are going to go from a Brit Hume clip to a discussion of the actual Arabic text of the Quran. Only on The Dividing Line would you go from Brit Hume telling Tiger Woods he needs to repent to a discussion like this. But I'm not sure that there's really all that much of a contradiction there. Because as you will recall on the last program, a caller was asking about, and I've got a ton of books sitting here. One of them, this commentary here, this, The Message of the Quran by Assad, Muhammad Assad, I'm holding it with one arm, but can just barely do that. I actually weighed this thing today. I got on a scale and then I picked that thing up. 10.5 pounds, just that one commentary. The thing is huge. The paper is really, really nice, but it's also very, very heavy. Anyway, I took the time to do what I said I would do. We had been discussing Surah 929, and you will hear Surah 929 probably more than any other ayah in the entirety of the Quran. I heard somebody make reference to it last night on a talk radio program. You can tell that 99% of the people citing Surah 929 have never read the rest of Surah 9 or any of the rest of the Quran, but they've just found it and they just keep re-quoting it over and over and over again. And if you are familiar with it, it is Surah 9 is the last of the surahs, at least close to the last of the surahs that was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, according to Islamic sources. And if we read the text, we note, just backing up a little bit, because it's always good to get a little bit of context, beginning verse 28, "O you who believe, truly the pagans are unclean, so let them not, after this year of theirs, approach the sacred mosque. And if you fear poverty, soon will God enrich you, and if he wills, out of his bounty, for God is all-knowing, all-wise." Now, this then becomes a basis upon which today unbelievers are not even allowed in Mecca. Non-Muslims are not allowed in Mecca. And you have the very strange situation where Christian churches cannot be built and freedom of worship is denied and so on and so forth because it's considered a holy place. A lot of this would go back to Surah 928. Then Surah 929. "Fight those who believe not in God nor the last day, nor hold that forbidden which hath been forbidden by God and his apostle, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are of the people of the book," the Ahlul Kitab, of the Jews and the Christians, "until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued, wahum sagidun." And what I had mentioned a couple of times in the past was a few months ago, my Arabic tutor and I were reading through Surah 7, and I believe Surah 32 is the parallel passage, and the casting out of Iblis, Satan, for refusing to bow down before Adam, which is in and of itself a rather interesting section. And we had a caller call in, and he was wanting to know, because I had mentioned that the same term that is rendered there, subdued, feel themselves subdued, was found in that parallel text in reference to Satan. And I wanted to make sure of exactly what I was referring to, and so I wanted to double-check things. If you look at Surah 7 in the Quran, beginning at about, let's say, Ayah 11, it is we who created you and gave you shape. Then we bade the angels bow down to Adam, and they bowed down, not so Iblis. He refused to be of those who bow down. God said, what prevented thee from bowing down when I commanded thee? He said, I am better than he. Thou didst create me from fire and him from clay. Allah says, get thee down from this. It is not for thee to be arrogant. Here, get out, for thou art of the meanest of creatures. Now, this is the, I believe, the Yusuf Ali translation. It's, you know, usable. But that is the same Arabic root that is found there. You are the meanest. That's a horrible translation. In essence, what he's saying is you are humiliated. You are being cast out, being put down. You can tell this by the next ayah, which says, he said, give me respite till the day they are raised up. And God said, be thou among those who have respite. And so Iblis says, because thou hast thrown me out of the way, lo, I will lie in wait for them on thy straight way. Then will I assault them from before them and behind them, from their right and their left. Nor wilt thou find in most of them gratitude for thy mercies. God said, get out from this, disgraced and expelled. If any of them follow thee, hell will I fill with you all. And so there is the section from Surah 7. Now, if you compare that with Surah 32, you'll see some differences in the story, telling the same story. And one of the interesting things about that is you will frequently hear people like Shabir Ali and others arguing that, since Mark and Matthew tell the story differently from one another, then that must mean that there's inaccuracies and the Bible really isn't inspired and things like that. Well, they have to answer the same question, except theirs is a little bit tougher situation because allegedly they only have one author. You can't talk about the fact that, well, you know, Matthew is bookending or telescoping or whatever else he's engaging in because they only have one author. And so I'll let them explain that. But be that as it may, there was the text. And so it was interesting. If you hear something fall over, it's because these books are rather precariously lying on one another. Sagara, the root that is used here in both 929 and in 713 is also found 7119, 1232, and 2737, which we're about to look at here. That's a very interesting use. It is actually used about 13 times in the Quran, and if you look at the Dictionary of the Holy Quran by Omar, when he gives the meaning of this group of words, remember, Arabic is a Semitic language just like Hebrew. And if you've ever looked at a Hebrew lexicon, you will see that it's organized by roots, and that means you get a semantic domain, a range of meanings related to the root. And then the various forms then will give you the specific meaning in the semantic domain that's being used. So under Sagura Sagira, to be small, little, one who is small, little, subdued, or abjected one, or in a state of subjection. Small, smaller, vileness, contempt, humiliation. These are the words that are given. The root in its above forms has been used in the Holy Quran about 13 times. Well, it's not about 13 times. It is exactly 13 times, according to this extensive concordance of the Quran by Qasas, which I think weighs about as much as the other thing did there. Now, what I wanted to do, and we'll get to our calls in a little while, this commentary that I have, which is published by CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, by Assad, is very, very interesting because of the huge commentary that is provided on this particular text. And why would there be such a huge commentary on this particular text? Well, for obvious reasons. Here is how Assad renders Surah 9:29, and fight against those who, despite having been vouchsafed revelation aforetime, that's the people of the book, do not truly believe either in God of the last day, and do not consider forbidden that which God and his apostle have forbidden, and do not follow the religion of truth which God has enjoined upon them, till they agree to pay the exemption tax with a willing hand after having been humbled in war. That's how he renders this particular text. Now, in the commentary, then, you get this very Western-like discussion. I think this is important because you will hear many people on talk shows and stuff like that quoting this verse. You need to know the best Islamic interpretations and know if they are consistent or not. And this goes back to the moderate versus radicalized argumentation. I can guarantee you Mr. Abdullah Muttalab, or whatever his name was, the underwear bomber, could give you a particular interpretation of this, one of these two. But he wouldn't have given you this interpretation, which is found in Assad. So, footnote 40, literally, such as those who were vouchsafed revelation aforetime as do not believe, in accordance with the fundamental principle observed throughout my interpretation of the Quran, that all of its statements and ordinances are mutually complementary and cannot therefore be correctly understood unless they are considered as parts of one integral whole. I just stop for a moment and say, that's a very Western way of looking at it, and not one that is overly practiced by your average Muslim, unfortunately. This verse, too, must be read in the context of the clear-cut Quranic rule that war is permitted only in self-defense, see 2:190-194 in the corresponding notes. Now, notice his method of interpretation is not the method of interpretation of Sayyid Qutb, Osama bin Laden, the Islamic Brotherhood, and pretty much anybody in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and many places like that. I don't think he goes over there very often and does lectures, but who knows? Maybe he does. In other words, the above injunction to fight is relevant only in the event of aggression committed against the Muslim community or state, or in the presence of an unmistakable threat to its security, a view which has been shared by that great Islamic thinker, Muhammad Abdah. Commenting on this verse, he declared, fighting has been made obligatory in Islam only for the sake of defending the truth and its followers. All the campaigns of the Prophet were defensive in character, and so were the wars undertaken by the companions in the earliest period of Islam. End quote. I'm just reading Assad here. You need to hear how they present this when they're in the minority. Now, I guess I can't avoid, however, commenting that the radicalized view understands this very differently, in the sense that they see the West as an imminent threat to all of Islam. Little different situation today as existed back then. Then the next note, this to my mind is the key phrase, the above ordinance. The term apostle is obviously used here in its generic sense and applies to all the prophets on whose writings the beliefs of Jews and Christians are supposed to be based, in particular to Moses and the case of the Christians to Jesus as well. Since earlier in the sentence, the people allude to are accused of so grave a sin as willfully refusing to believe in God in the last day, that is, in life after death, a man's individual responsibility for his doings on earth, it is inconceivable they should subsequently be blamed for comparatively minor offenses against their religious law. Consequently, the stress on their not forbidding that which God and his apostle have forbidden must refer to something which is as grave or almost as grave as disbelief in God. In the context of an ordinance enjoining war against them, this something can mean only one thing, namely unprovoked aggression. For it is this that has been forbidden by God through all the apostles who are entrusted with conveying his message to man. Thus, the above verse must be understood as a call to believers to fight against such, and only such, of the nominal followers of earlier revelation as deny their own professed belief by committing aggression against the followers of the Quran. So how does Assad explain Surah 9:29? By interpreting this terrible thing that they do as being committing unprovoked aggression against the Muslims. Then, when he gets down to the having been humbled in war, he puts in war in brackets anyways, feel themselves subjected. This is the Sagada term that we're looking at. Here's his discussion. And having become incorporated in the Islamic State, the term jizya, rendered by me as exemption tax, occurs in the Quran only once, but its meaning and purpose have been fully explained in many authentic traditions. Here's another one of those places, by the way, where without the hadith, the Quran is completely beyond understanding. You've got to have the hadith, but who gets to filter that? Who gets to decide that? Which collections are you going to trust, etc., etc.? It's very important in the interpretation of the Quran. It is intimately bound up with the concept of the Islamic State as an ideological organization, and this is a point which must always be borne in mind if the real purport of this tax is to be understood. In the Islamic State, every able-bodied Muslim is obliged to take up arms in jihad, that is, in a just war in God's cause, whenever the freedom of his faith or the political safety of his community is imperiled. I stop just long enough to remind you, once again, Islam is not just a religion, it is a political system. The two cannot be separated from one another, and if you can't hear that in this, then you're not listening. It's there. It's the only way to understand this. We cannot interpret this in our categories. It is a religious political system. In other words, every able-bodied Muslim is liable to compulsory military service. Since this is primarily a religious obligation, non-Muslim citizens who do not subscribe to the ideology of Islam cannot, in fairness, be expected to assume a similar burden. On the other hand, they must be accorded full protection of all their civic rights and of their religious freedom. Sounds so great, unless you've actually seen how Christians are treated in Islamic societies, but it sounds good when it's being published by CARE. And it is in order to compensate the Muslim community for this unequal distribution of civic burdens that a special tax is levied on non-Muslim citizens, that is, covenanted or protected people, i.e. non-Muslims whose safety is statutorily assured by the Muslim community. Thus, jizya is no more and no less than an exemption tax in lieu of military service and in compensation for the covenant of protection, dhimma, that's why they're called dhimmis, accorded to such citizens by the Islamic State. The term itself is derived from the term jaza, he rendered something as a satisfaction or as a compensation in lieu of something else. No fixed rate has been set either by the Quran or by the Prophet for this tax, but from all available traditions it is evident that it is to be considerably lower than the tax called zakah, the purifying duties, to which Muslims are liable and which, because it is a specifically Islamic religious duty, is naturally not to be levied on non-Muslims. Only such of the non-Muslim citizens who, if they were Muslims, would be expected to serve in the armed forces of the state are liable to the payment of jizya, provided they can easily afford it. Accordingly, all non-Muslim citizens whose personal status or condition would automatically free them from the obligation to render more military service are statutorily, that is, on the basis of clear-cut ordinances promulgated by the Prophet, exempted from the payment of jizya. All women, males who have not yet reached full maturity, old men, all sick or crippled men, priests and monks. All non-Muslim citizens who volunteer for military service are obviously exempted from the payment of jizya. So there is Assad's commentary, and I think it is vitally important. I don't know many people in the secular media that are doing due diligence to take the time to find out what is it, what's the best the Muslims have to offer. And if they've published this stuff, they've put this stuff out and said, here it is, we have, I think, a responsibility to listen to it and go, all right, there is the assertion. But, and we're just going to skip it. Don't worry about it today. sorry. Here's the problem. It sounded good. And Assad is saying, hey, we need to look at all the Quran says, and we need to allow the Quran to be a consistent whole. Wonderful. I don't think you can do it, but wonderful. You know, as long as you let us do the same thing, my Muslim opponents never get, you know, let me do that. But okay, I'll grant that to you. But here's the problem. There is a direct parallel phrase, same term, same form even, in the Quran. And Assad never makes reference to it. Doesn't say a word about it. And yet, it tells us a lot. And this was pointed out to me when I made reference to this on the last dividing line. I posted the material after the program about the terms. Good old Sam Shamoon got in touch with me. And he reminded us of Surah 27. And that is listed in the Casus Concordance, of course. So it's not like this was unknown to Assad. He would have known that it was there. He just chose not to comment on it. And I'm going to back up and read you the whole context here. In Surah 27, you have the story of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And it is, the only way to make any sense, since I've spent this much time on it, is to read it to you. And I realize that for some folks, since I'm not mentioning Dave Hunt or Calvinism at the moment, click and they're disappearing. But for the dozen of you or so that are left, Surah 27, beginning at verse Ayah 15. We gave in the past knowledge to David and Solomon, and they both said, "Praise be to God who has favored us above many of his servants who believe." And Solomon was David's heir. He said, "O ye people, we have been taught the speech of birds, and on us has been bestowed a little of all things. This is indeed grace manifest from God. And before Solomon were marshaled his hosts of jinns and men and birds, and they were all kept in order and ranks. At length, when they came to a lowly valley of ants, one of the ants said, 'O ye ants, get into your habitations, lest Solomon and his hosts crush you underfoot without knowing it.' So he smiled, amused at her speech, and he said, 'O my lord, so order me that I may be grateful for thy favors, which thou hast bestowed on me and on my parents, and that I may work the righteousness that will please thee. Admit me by thy grace to the ranks of thy righteous servants.' And he took a muster of the birds, and he said, 'Why is it I see not the hoopoe? Or is he among the absentees? I will certainly punish him with a severe penalty or execute him unless he bring me a clear reason for absence.' But the hoopoe tarried not far. He came up and said," this is a bird talking to Solomon, "'I have compassed territory which thou hast not compassed, for I have come to thee from Saba with tidings true." Saba would be Sheba, Queen of Sheba. "'I found there a woman ruling over them and provided with every requisite, and she has a magnificent throne. I found her and her people worshipping the sun besides God. Satan has made their deeds seem pleasing in their eyes and has kept them away from the path so they receive no guidance. Kept them away from the path that they should not worship God who brings to light what is hidden in the heavens and the earth and knows what ye hide and what ye reveal. God, there is no God but he, Lord of the throne supreme.' Solomon said, 'Soon shall we see whether thou hast told the truth or lied.'" So Solomon is talking to the bird who has reported this. "'Go thou with this letter of mine and deliver it to them, then draw back from them and wait to see what answer they return.' The queen said, 'Ye chiefs, here is delivered to me a letter worthy of respect,'" though it evidently was delivered by a bird. "'It is from Solomon and is as follows.'" Here's the letter. Here's the letter that Solomon sends. Now, let me just mention to you that what Sam indicates is that Muhammad is molding Solomon into his own image here, and that this is parallel to what Muhammad did and gave example of doing. Here's what the letter says: "Be ye not arrogant against me, but come to me in submission to the true religion." Now, remember, what is Islam? Submission. So, do not be arrogant against me, but become Muslims, is what the letter says to the Queen of Sheba. She said, "Ye chiefs, advise me in this my affair. No affair have I decided except in your presence." They said, "We are endued with strength and given to vehement war, but the command is with thee, so consider what thou wilt command." She said, "Kings, when they enter a country, despoil it and make the noblest of its people its meanest. Thus do they behave. But I am going to send him a present and wait to see with what answer return my ambassadors." Now, when the embassy came to Solomon, he said, "Will you give me abundance and wealth? But that which God has given me is better than that which he has given you. Nay, it is you who rejoice in your gift. Go back to them and be sure we shall come to them. Listen to what this is what Solomon says. Go back to them and be sure we shall come to them with such hosts as they will never be able to meet. We shall expel them from there in disgrace, and they will feel humbled indeed. Wahum Sagiruna. Let me give you another translation. Then Suleiman said to the chiefs of her messengers who brought the present, go back to them. We verily shall come to them with hosts which they cannot resist, and we shall drive them out from there in disgrace, and they will be abased. Wahum Sagiruna. He said, O chiefs, which of you can bring me her throne before they come to me, surrendering themselves in obedience? So what happens here? Solomon says, I'm going to come and I'm going to destroy you unless you become Muslims. Now, these were not people that were attacking the Muslims. This was not an invading army. He didn't even know about these people. The hoopoe bird had to tell him about these people. And yet Solomon does what Muhammad does. Muhammad would take the very same course of action. He would send the letter inviting the idolaters to Islam, threaten them if they refuse, and then he prepares to attack them if they do not become Muslims. And that then becomes the foundation of exactly what you see in the Muslim Brotherhood and the radicalized form of Islam. And the question is, if the Assad moderate interpretation of the Quran is correct, why not make reference to this direct parallel? It's the exact same phrase. It's the exact same phrase. And yet here they feel themselves subdued. They are abased because the Muslims attack them in their own homeland. And there's the problem. The problem exists in the texts themselves and in the resultant actions of Muhammad that becomes the foundation of the quote-unquote radicalized interpretation, which really is nothing more than the Quranic interpretation, the historic interpretation. Now, again, I wish my moderate friends all the luck in arguing their case, but if Assad is a good example, and if you were listening carefully, I know that, you know, sometimes people tune out, but if you're listening carefully, it really seemed to me that his comments were specifically meant to communicate the idea that, oh, you know, this jizya isn't any big thing. It's only on people that wouldn't be in military service, and it's actually less than what the Muslims are supposed to pay, and so aren't we wonderful? And we've seen how jizya has been used historically, but it sounded like an apologetic application is what we were getting, an apologetic application. Well, if you're going to give an apologetic application, shouldn't you deal with a exact use of the exact same phrase in a very similar context elsewhere in the Quran, make reference to it, explain it? I think you sort of have to, but he didn't. So there's the phraseology, there's the terminology, there's an examination of the text of the Quran. I again understand, you know, people say, well, you know, that's great, but could you have like maybe a different webcast where you talk about Islam or something like that? No, not really. I really hope that someday people are going to look back and go, I'm so thankful that you just kept bringing this to our attention because we're having to deal with it now, and at least we're not stuck, you know, at first base. We've at least got something to go on because you're doing that. So anyways, 877-753-3341 is the phone number. I'm looking at my tweets here. A Voice of the Sheep asked, have you seen the subsequent interview of Hume on O'Reilly's show? Yep, because I just played that. And don't see anything in the other one. So see, I'm looking at both of them now. So hopefully I should be seeing any questions there that are being asked at Dr. Oakley 1689. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. And Johnny from California is going to try to trip me up yet again by completely shifting the topic probably going to ask me something about what the eschatological viewpoints of a particular pope was around 1453 on July 3rd at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Right, Johnny?
Yeah, exact. That was exactly the exact date and time, yeah. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing pretty good.
Well, Happy New Year, by the way.
It is a new year, is it not? Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Well, brother, a friend of mine and I have been actually doing some research on the subject of death in the afterlife.
Okay.
And I actually picked up a few books, one by Philip S. Johnson called Shades of Sheol, and The Death of Death by a man named Neil Gilliam. And basically what we're kind of interested in your opinion, of what would be the best academic book that would present the Old Testament doctrine of the, I mean, obviously the New Testament has a much more developed
right.
understanding of the afterlife than the Old Testament does.
Mm-hmm.
But given the books that I'm reading, even like N.T. Wright's book on the resurrection, N.T. Wright dates, for example, the book of Daniel in the 2nd century B.C.
Right.
And when you look at the liberal sources that are out there, they see a gradual development from First Temple Judaism to Second Temple Judaism and the Hellenization and stuff like that. And so when we look at a passage in Genesis where it'll say that a saint passed away and that he went to be with his fathers, we would see that as a reference to the afterlife.
Well, yeah, sort of. It could be in that sense, mm-hmm. though we are reading that from our perspective. The exact nature of Sheol is not brought out a whole lot until the prophetic period, which, as you pointed out, liberals like to place those writings, you know, way, way, way down the road. But your primary problem here is that the vast majority of stuff that is published in Old Testament studies today is conservatives gave up the Old Testament to liberals a long, long time ago, and there are only a few people. The Bruce Waltkes and Gleason Archers, Dr. Merrill at Dallas, the conservatives in the Old Testament area, but they are few and far between in comparison to the liberals in that area. And so I would think that probably your best resource for looking for, I don't know if there are quote unquote books on the subject, but you're probably going to find articles in obscure theological journals on subjects like that. I don't know if you have the Logos Theological Journals Library CD, DVDs, or whatever it is, the forum they have now. But
no, I don't.
That's obviously a really good place to search because you're having to look through theological journals. In fact, someone that was on the ministry resource list and then it disappeared, but I haven't seen it yet, so I'm a little concerned about that. But anyway, make a long story short, I would suggest contacting Dr. Waltke because I do know that he responds to folks and he's quite active. He and I spoke at a conference a number of years ago up in Toronto, and a really sharp guy. And if anyone would have maybe a bibliography from a class that he's taught, that would have those types of articles already there, it would probably be Bruce Waltke.
Bruce Waltke, is it?
Waltke,
okay.
W-A-L-T-K-E, yes.
Oh,
Bruce Waltke.
Okay, because I don't know, are you familiar with this particular book? Because it's written by a Jewish man, The Death of Death by Neil Gilman.
No.
No, because the thing about this, and because my friend, he actually studies more of, he's more up to date on rabbinic Judaism of this era, and he's got a lot of, you know, the Talmud and stuff like that from Second Temple Judaism, and he's saying that because for a long time, at least in the 19th and 20th centuries, Jews have pretty much been pretty quiet about the subject of the afterlife. But this book right here, they're saying is sending a bit of a tidal wave, saying that they want to, I think, reclaim their roots, and that there is more discussion about subjects like the afterlife and resurrection now coming up in Judaism, which I think would be very helpful in our studies of the afterlife as a whole.
Well, I think it would be actually, now that you mention that, sometime, and we need to set the date, but I think sometime about a month from now, I'm supposed to be on Michael Brown's program to debate Calvinism with him, but he knows Judaism really well, being a former Jew himself, and that's his area of study. He also might be someone who would have some materials on afterlife stuff like that, and he's fairly easy to get in contact with as well. He has a radio program that he does and stuff like that, so that might be another direction to go. But there's a difference between knowing where the Jews are today as a people and Old Testament studies. There's a huge difference between the two. I mean, most Jews today, I mean, if you've listened to Michael Brown's debate with Shmuley Boltiak on the Unbelievable Radio program that I talked about a few weeks ago, most Jews today have an extremely low view of Scripture as far as its consistency and inspiration and things like that. It's much more of a cultural artifact than it is a divine revelation. And so that has to be kept in mind, too, when thinking of the difference between where Jews are now and where they were, in the Second Temple Judaism or during the period of development between the First and Second Temple.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you say that because I agree with you wholeheartedly there. But one of the things that my friend was telling me was that there were certain prayers that were being done, I guess, on the liturgical level by Jews, and that these prayers would have actual references to, you know, things like the afterlife that were actually removed from the prayers by modern Jews. But the attention that is being paid towards ancient Judaism and the idea of reclaiming their roots, I think is a step in the right direction and should be helpful in that particular area because it's the way it's being portrayed by the liberal left is that the concept of Hellenization infiltrated Judaism, which in then turned around and infiltrated Christianity,
right.
And now the Jews are going back to the original form or something like that. And he also told me that there's a difference between, like, when we use the word reformed in our circles, we see that as the most conservative wing of Christianity
right.
On theological level, but with reformed Jews, that's actually the most, like, leftist view of Christianity.
Right.
And for them, it's the Orthodox Jews, so it's very interesting.
Yeah, the terminology is different, definitely. But, yeah, it's a difficult area. I am sure that there are some works on the subject, but they're probably buried in those theological journals. So Bruce Waltke or Michael Brown probably would be able to put you on to finding what you're looking for there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay,
God
thanks
bless.
A lot. God bless. Bye-bye. Yeah, I need to get back with Dr. Brown, in fact, today, if I can. He had emailed me. I think we were looking at something around the 26th or so, but I'm also trying to do the same type of thing with Tim Staples on Purgatory as far as being on the program. I'm going to be on Michael's program, then we're going to have Michael on this program. But we also need to do the program with Tim Staples, which we want to go for 90 minutes on that. I know that a week from this Thursday, I won't be able to do the program because I'll be teaching at Golden Gate in Mill Valley. So I leave next week to go up there. And in fact, I just realized I leave a week from today. So I'm not sure what we're going to do about that. I think my flight is right around now, actually. So I may be, I don't know, we'll check. I'll check to see what my flight time is on Tuesday to get up there. I may have to go to the airport 2 days early, you know, to get through all the screening, stuff like that. You never know. But anyhow, we may have some interruptions next week. And then the week after that, Dr. Joseph Pipa is going to be on the program. We're going to be talking about the conference that I'll be speaking at back at Greenville Presbyterian Seminary, where the widely accepted attire includes bow ties. And so I will fit in very, very well. Rich just grimaced in pain. But Vadi Balcom recently I saw him speaking in a bow tie. So we're starting to take over. We're starting to infiltrate, and we're getting a little farther into
The cult begins.
It's not a cult. It is
first the Mac.
It is the bleeding edge.
No, first
edge.
John Denver. Then the Mac. And now the bow ties.
It's the bleeding edge of reformed fashion. Is what it is.
Bleeding edge. That's right.
Anyway, so we've got a lot to do as far as guests and programs, and obviously I would like to have at least some time to do some preparation, especially for the Tim Staples program. So it's going to be...
So what, we have a little time to kill here. What would we do next Tuesday if we can't get you on? Would we try the Monday show?
Maybe.
Or maybe try to do a super early one on Tuesday?
I don't know.
Barry wants to sit in and take
my role?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
He's learned how to run the board, and now he figures to do your side, too.
Okay. it could be very interesting. It also could be one of the last Dividing Lines ever done. That would be the second to last. The last would be my apologizing for the previous Dividing Line as we went off the air.
Yeah. Actually, you know, somebody in the channel just pointed out, I did forget, it was John Denver, it was the Mac, it was the kilt that came before the Mac. So it was John Denver, the kilt, the Mac, now the bow tie cult.
You know, you're really jealous. I can't. You really shouldn't express these things on the program. So
yes,
anyway, and then in February, first weekend of February, be in Georgia, Conyers, Georgia. And then we really need to, I keep mentioning this, we really need to get a graphic up on the website about raising money to go to the United Kingdom.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, got to get to the United Kingdom. That would be a good thing to do. So we'll try to get those things on the blog as soon as we can, but especially the graphic. That's the only way people see that, is to try to do that. So that's February. I can't see it from here. Why are they? There's February. It's the weekend of the 20th and 21st. It'd be just probably a few days before that, and then most of the week afterwards. But I haven't heard back from a number of the people in England yet as to getting things set up and arranged. So I'm a little concerned about that, but we'll keep pressing. It's been the holidays and stuff like that, and a lot of folks just now starting to try to dig out from all the emails and everything else, but so we've got a lot of stuff going on. My calendar is scary full all the way into the summer already, with trips all over the place, including one to Leavenworth, Colorado. Hopefully they'll let me back out, because that's the only thing I know about Leavenworth, is you go there and you stay there for many years, and you don't have to worry about bow ties or anything when you're in Camp Leavenworth. But there are actually people who live there that are not incarcerated in the prison there. So we'll be up in Colorado. I believe that's in May. Yes, that's in May. And then heading for North Carolina the same week. In fact, I'm going to have to go from Colorado to North Carolina. And a hoped-for, haven't gotten word on it yet, but a hoped-for major debate in early May. Actually, I'm sorry, it's not North Carolina. It's Florida. It's Florida. But it would still be a major debate in the Florida area in May, but I can't give that information yet because these things take time to put together. So once we know details, we will provide them to you. Thanks for listening to Dividing Line today. Rather eclectic, from Brit Hume to Islam to death and the afterlife in Judaism. But we like mixing it all up here. Hopefully not leaving you mixed up in the process. Thanks for listening to Dividing Line. We'll see you Thursday. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.